This holiday season, comfort means slowing down and finding calm amid the chaos. Create your natural oasis by prioritizing rest, comfort, and connection with Avocado Green Mattress. As the holidays fill up with gatherings and to-do lists, Avocado mattresses and home essentials provide the foundation for deeper rest, calmer mornings, and a healthier daily routine. Every product is thoughtfully made with the planet in mind, so you can feel good about the comfort and quality you bring into your home. Avocado is better for you and better for the planet. And to make your purchase more accessible, you'll have easy financing options with Affirm. Prioritize rest and recharge with Avocado's organic comfort. Head to avocadogreenmattress.com today to create your natural oasis and save big during their holiday sale. Avocado, dream of better.
The old world is dying. The new world struggles to be born. Now is the time of monsters. With those words, I welcome you to the Time of Monsters podcast. I'm Jeet here of The Nation magazine, which is a sponsor of this podcast. But this week is actually a kind of special podcast. We're still the Time of Monsters because we're going to take up, you know, one of the biggest monsters of our era, Jeffrey Epstein. But we are co-producing this with another podcast hosted by my guest, Van Jackson, who has been on the show before, is an international relations scholar, although one who perhaps has a different bent than the mainstream of that field, who is hosts the Undiplomatic podcast, and this will also run on Undiplomatic. So I'll let Van introduce himself. Thanks for being on, and yeah, let's do the intro for your show.
Yeah, what's up, gang? Thanks for joining the Undiplomatic podcast crossover with the Time of Monsters podcast. This is such an important episode. I feel like as we're recording this, I'm every tweet I see, every new email I open is another crazy bombshell that is just mind blowing about the Jeffrey Epstein stuff. Mm-hmm. But I think what I mean, and so there's an infinite amount of like Jeffrey Epstein content to talk about here. But aside from like the humor and scandalousness and outrage of it all, which is worth talking about, I felt like you and I were two of the few people who were like actively trying to make sense of this stuff or like put it in a context or a framework or something, you know? Like we saw more than just the sexcapades.
Oh, no, absolutely. I mean, like, obviously, you know, when people mention the name Jeffrey Epstein, I mean, the first thing that comes to mind, you know, quite properly are the sort of horrific crimes that he was guilty of, which kind of like boggle the imagination. And then the second thing that comes to mind is, you know, like his many elite associates, including some of the wealthiest and most powerful people in the world. I mean, this is a guy who received, you know, salacious birthday greetings from two, like, you know, living presidents, Bill Clinton and Donald Trump, and has been responsible for a member of the House of Windsor losing their royal status, the former prince known as Prince Andrew. But, you know, but I think that lost in all this is a, you know, a sense of something that's incorporates the sex scandal, but is also like who this figure is. Like, how did he get into like all these elite circles? I mean, this is actually someone who's like a college dropout, was kind of a financial advisor. I mean, the famous Conan O'Brien thing is, you know, Jeffrey Epstein, the New York financier. But I mean, but who, but also knew all these elite people. And I think that his ties to all these elite people, and when I'm seeing this in the sort of emails that are dropping, you know, some of these people might have been accomplices of his in sex crimes, but not necessarily like all of them. And many of them are very elite people, especially in the sort of realm of foreign policy, which is why I think Undiplomatic is a good venue for this. You know, people who are like leaders in the CIA and involved heavily in the Clinton, Obama, and Trump administrations. Now, this is stuff that generally gets ignored. And I want to do a call out to like two venues that have not ignored it, which are going to be the source for our conversation. One of which is Reason Magazine, which did a story about by Matthew Petty about Epstein's connections with the spy industry, how he was involved with former Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak and a surveillance tech company. And building on that and doing a lot of groundbreaking research, DropSite has done a whole bunch of articles basically fleshing out just how tight Epstein's connections were with Barak and the services that Epstein provided the Israeli state. And I think, you know, there's not so much evidence of this, but we have to put this, I think, foreground on the table, that there's no way an American citizen was involved with these activities without the knowledge of the American intelligence, at least.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, so I mean, what Dropsy, to excellent reporting by Ryan Graham and Murtaza Hussein, has shown is that Epstein was involved with back-channel negotiations between Israel and Russia to deal with the settlement of Syria. He was involved with opening up ties between Israel and Mongolia and selling Israeli surveillance technology to African countries. So, I mean, that's quite a list of activities.
Well, can I go like slightly further even? I mean, like, the like Israeli relationship to like Mongolia and West African countries, they were selling like an Israeli security state in a box, like the tools of repression, soup to nuts, almost like it was an app, like a, you know, plug and play kind of thing, selling that to West African countries, to Mongolia. And this was the tip of the iceberg. And so there's a way in which Jeffrey Epstein was an arms dealer. We were talking about this before we hit record, but there's much more going on here. And so like the way I you know, I had a piece that I wrote about this in the newsletter a few days ago, I characterized him as a geopolitician, which is to me an epithet, but he's trying to, and sort of succeeding in the worst way, trying to manipulate power politics. And what we saw, like my thesis was like, Epstein is the embodiment of power politics in neoliberal globalization. And that happens to be very corrupt at its core. So this thing that we called like the liberal international order, right? There in Washington, there's like this romantic gloss on what that was. But what that really was agents like Epstein profiteering from world affairs and helping consolidate state control of societies. And so American hegemony imposed a kind of imperialist peace on the world, especially in like Asia. And that imperialist peace was basically peace for rulers, but imperialism for the ruled, like society. Mm. And so American hegemony is like secured ruling class solidarity, basically, but against working class interests. And that sets up like everything that The Nation magazine does, all the progressive politics stuff that we're like part of and we talk about and write about the past decade, all of that stuff, BDS, opposing genocide, eliminating tax havens, free buses, cutting military spending, it's all a threat to the control of rulers over their people. And as rulers have less control, their ruling class solidarity starts to break. And Jeffrey Epstein was one of these guys who was making ruling class solidarity work. And one of the sites of ruling class solidarity happened to be Pedo Island. And, you know, everybody gets to take their turn stabbing Caesar, basically, by being complicit in like human trafficking.
Absolutely. And I think maybe one way to kind of think about this is to sort of like historicize Jeffrey Epstein as a figure of the 1990s. I mean, he seems to have like acquired his sort of, you know, like wealth and elite connections at some
Davos
point,
man,
in the 80s. But really like starts to like flourish in the sort of, you know, end of history moment of the 1990s. And if you look at, I mean, what we're getting is a sort of, from some of these documents, is a kind of fleshed out view of his politics. And I should say, like, you know, this doesn't necessarily discredit these politics. I mean, obviously, like many totally innocent people hold these politics. But basically, like, if you look at like what Epstein believed in, and why he was so comfortable in the company of people like Bill Clinton and Donald Trump, was that Epstein basically believed what the American ruling class came to think in the 1990s. You know, he believed in globalization via the Washington Consensus, STEM-dominated education, U.S. military hegemony, especially in the Middle East, with Israel as a very important asset, elite comity, you know, like bringing together people from the center left and the center right with shared vision, the fetishization of the tech industry, you know, very much into like the Bitcoin and things like that, and a kind of male-centered sexual liberalism. I mean, like if
that's
one
way
like,
to put it.
Like, so like this is like basically the you know, that is the sort of you know, politics of a large chunk of the elite in the 1990s, and it still continues to be very powerful, although it has been increasingly under challenge from on both the left and the right. So he operated within that like ideological space, but was like also an entrepreneur and was someone who realized that, you know, within this world, there were a lot of opportunities, as you said, precisely because this end of history moment was a moment of deregulation and of the sort of flourishing, what was quoted as, you know, we're allowing civil society to flourish, but it's really like, you know, allowing powerful business interests to kind of come to the fore. So I think that is a sort of cultural milieu that he's sort of coming out of. I mean, do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, well, so everything you're saying, like, Naomi Klein's book, The Shock Doctrine, back in the Bush years, she had this whole like disaster capitalism thesis, and it was the more like intense version of that argument was that like our foreign policy creates destabilizing geopolitical events almost on purpose, mm-hmm. because the chaos is then ripe for like resource extraction and deregulation and kleptocracy, and that's how people secure the bag and get paid or whatever. So that, and like in the good faith about national security years of those early 2000s, people read that almost as like conspiracy theory thinking. Mm-hmm. But like all of these email dumps from like DropSite and from the Democratic House Oversight thing, these emails are like smoking gun proof that thesis has legs. I mean, like that's what's going on. You know, like what you see in the emails, we didn't talk about this yet, but like Jeffrey Epstein and Ehud Barak, Israel's former prime minister and former minister of defense, they were talking about how Epstein was so close to Russian oligarchs that not only had he met with Putin repeatedly, but Putin sought a meeting with Jeffrey Epstein, and Epstein turned him down at one point until, I forget what the quote was, but until Putin could agree to meet in private and in a secure setting or something like that.
Yeah.
And like the whole like triangle of conspiracy with Syria, Iran, Russia, and Israel, I guess that's not a triangle. The thing that was going on there was like they being Epstein, was trying to get the U.S. to bomb Iran. Mm-hmm. They were trying to undermine what became the JCPOA, the Iran nuclear mm-hmm. deal. They were trying to depose Bashar al-Assad because mm-hmm. Israel saw Assad as an Iranian proxy. And they were trying to get chemical weapons out of Syria because they were afraid that some proxy group or whatever would end up using them against Israel. Mm-hmm. And so Russia was crucial in the Epstein imagination to resolving most of those wish list items. And so Epstein literally, like this, the Ryan Grimm, Murtaza Hussein stuff is just mind blowing because it shows, okay, Epstein and Ehud Barak, they're going to go to the UN General Assembly and meet with all these people to persuade them about these wish list items, wish list of death, right? They're going to go meet with John Kerry when he's Secretary of State and push him on this. They're going to go to Henry Kissinger's 90th birthday. This is literally in the emails. Henry Kissinger's 90th birthday, because they know John Kerry will be there and they know a bunch of so-and-sos from the White House will be there to push them on these agenda items. And then they're literally in the same month going to go to the Kremlin and meet with Russian oligarchs and the Russian foreign minister to get Russia to support deposing Bashar al-Assad. And they don't end up getting Bashar al-Assad removal. They don't get approval for that, but they do get this arrangement of what becomes the Russia-US agreement to like inspect and dispose of Syrian chemical weapons in 2013. Mm-hmm. And just like a very small anecdote here, in 2013, I worked in Obama's Pentagon. A lot of my friends worked on the WMD side of the Pentagon, and most of what they did in 2013, all of them, was this project to get chemical weapons out of Syria. So like mission accomplished from the Jeffrey Epstein perspective. Yeah. But like what's crazy about is that from their perspective, from the perspective of the policy technocrat dude who was doing non-proliferation stuff and he thinks he's doing God's work, right? And there's a bunch of them in the system. What they were really doing the whole time was serving the agenda of Jeffrey Epstein and Israel, mm-hmm. who wanted that to happen. And Jeffrey Epstein was the guy pushing on all the right doors to make it happen. And then it happened, mm-hmm. you know, and it's just wild to think that, like, you're part of this, you know, national security machinery, and you think you're doing stuff on behalf of whatever is going in your imagination about why this is a good thing to do. But that's not what's driving the train. What's driving the train is this external force with the name Jeffrey Epstein in part, and mm-hmm. and it's serving Israeli interests, mm-hmm. and it's only serving America's interests because of the way our elites choose to define U.S. interests as Israeli interests, right? Crazy, yeah. Crazy.
No. Absolutely. I mean, the Russian side of this, I think maybe we should explore like a little bit more, just because I think that there are various fellow geopoliticians who also have like some sort of interest in Russia for other reasons, maybe than Jeffrey Epstein did, but we're willing to use him as a conduit. And I think that explains some of the stuff in the emails that we're seeing with his like ties to Peter Thiel, and perhaps even like Steve Bannon, because although Epstein, you know, was obviously had been on the outs from Donald Trump for a long time, he came very close to Bannon during Trump's first term and would meet up with Bannon and was trying to, I guess, facilitate Bannon's own efforts to like make an outreach into Europe. So I find that interesting. Like, you know, like there's like I think these are all like actors with maybe like different overlapping, but, you know, distinct kind of foreign policy visions, but they can all find uses for each other on occasion.
Yeah, I was kind of, again, mind blown. Like, A, I didn't realize that Bannon was in cahoots with Epstein. Like, that was news to me, and maybe I just missed the boat earlier.
Oh, I wanted to claim just a little bit of credit, although I didn't do a lot about this. But like when I was working at for the New Republic in 2017 and 2018, I had done a few like little items, taking note of various reports that Bannon was meeting with Epstein and like trying to like beat the drums on this. Like why aren't people like taking note of, you know, this fact that like because I mean, like, to their credit, the New York Post did like report various sightings of Bannon going into Epstein's mansion. So
I had missed that. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I mean, it totally flew under the radar, because unless you were like really keyed into the New York tabloid press, they were the only ones ignoring it. If you just read the New York Times, like this stuff, it wouldn't have even registered at all, which is interesting. I mean, like, we can get to that later, but like the degree to which the elite media ignores this stuff.
So, yeah, we need to get more to the geopolitics, but just very quickly, in 2017, when everybody started realizing that Bannon is this strategist intellectual for the far right, I wrote a piece about what it meant that this guy was functioning in this power broker role, mm-hmm. but for the far right, you know? Mm-hmm. And I had talked to two different editors at two different publications about running it. They both told me separately, not about the merits of the piece, but that they don't want to give Bannon oxygen. And so they are refusing to publish any pieces about Bannon or that show Bannon doing things in the world. Mm-hmm. They're like, why should we care about Bannon? And I'm like, well, the whole piece is about why we should care about Bannon. What are you talking about? And they're like, well, we know that if we publish it, we're making Bannon out to be an influencer. And I'm like, but he is an influencer.
Yeah. So, because he had been a presidential advisor. Like he ran the Trump successful presidency. I mean, you don't know. That was a kind of very common liberal reaction. I remember, you know, I mean, one can debate the merits of the New Yorker inviting Bannon to their festival and then later canceling
it.
That's
a bit rich. But I
was puzzled by people not understanding that this is an inherently newsworthy person, and yeah, ignoring his activities, which so I mean, like for someone like Ehud Barak, but also Peter Thiel and Steve Bannon, one of the uses of a Jeffrey Epstein is that he can open doors. He can like get you in with figures, with Russian oligarchs, or apparently like with European figures in the case of Steve Bannon. So in some ways, I mean, this shows that the sort of networking aspect of Epstein, the sort of, you know, the his famous social life, you know, which included not just like the island, but also like dinner parties in his Manhattan residence where, you know, he would have, I think Woody Allen described it as, you know, you would see like all sorts of people, like diplomats and military people and magicians. So that social life, I mean, that is actually something that he was selling, right? Like he was selling an ability to connect people.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, there's a way in which you could say that, like, the unipolar so Jeffrey Epstein is a creature that the unipolar moment kind of created. And insofar as that's true, the unipolar moment also kind of accelerated or caused the global far right, you know, because Epstein is this, like, Bannon is actively a transnational actor trying to foment far-right governments around the world. And in Trump 1.0 especially, Russia was widely viewed as like the cultural beacon for the global far-right because of, you know, just its right-coded politics. And like, so the idea that like Epstein's working with the Gulf monarchies and Eastern European countries and Steve Bannon and Peter Thiel, who's like the key financier for a lot of this stuff, and Russian oligarchs, that's like the beating heart, all those characters of the global far right. You know what I mean? And yeah, like,
no, absolutely. Absolutely. But as you said, like in part, it's an alliance or a consensus that is based on a shared vision of the world, which is authoritarianism and keeping the actual masses out of politics. I mean, in some ways that was what the end of history was. It was like, you know, from what everyone can say about the, you know, the Soviet Union and that version of state capitalism, I think for the people who celebrated the end of history, it was the idea that, well, we don't have to worry about any challenges to the system. The system has won, and yeah, everything is going to operate within the system. And you know, you would need military and surveillance to keep it that way, to maintain that status quo, to make sure that, you know, we don't ever have a situation again where any unruly forces could present an alternative to the system.
That's what American hegemony was like, way, way more dystopian than it was being narrated as, and then as we were sort of taught growing up, you know? And like our criticisms would get funneled in, like left criticisms would get funneled into like criticizing moments, like, oh, the Iraq War or something like that. But the whole system that sort of gave rise to the Iraq War was this swampy pedo nonsense that Jeffrey Epstein kind of represented. And like, that's, you just can't avoid reaching that conclusion when you look through the email after email from this dump. To your point about the parties, dude, what's his name? The filmmaker guy that you just mentioned, Woody Allen. Like, yeah. To the extent people know who I am, like they know I fled DC, they know I left the blob, I moved to the other side of the planet, I became Washington's biggest critic or whatever. What almost nobody knows is like why, and like I don't want to overstate this, but a little bit of the why, like the Epstein stuff is the answer to that. I mean, so like I was not in any of these Epstein emails for sure, and like I didn't ever hear of the guy, but he is like an archetype or like a more exaggerated version of everybody in Washington. And like, as I was moving up the ranks of the national security state, I saw more and more of power operating like Epstein. Mm-hmm. And it was reaching the point where it was like, dude, I'm going to have to take my turn stabbing Caesar or else I have to get out. And it was clear that there wasn't going to be a third option at some point. So that was, I mean, that's like, this is like the thing that disturbs me and is so damning, and why I felt the need to even like write about it and even speak about it, is because it's like, this is emblematic of how the system operates. This is not an anomaly. This is not a weird one-off or whatever. Although some of this stuff is like comically flagrant and exaggerated.
No. I mean, Epstein himself is very exaggerated, but he represents a type, like of which they're like, you know, more socially acceptable versions, but they're still on the same spectrum.
This was also like the Bannon stuff. He, you know, Bannon fashions himself as a populist. Mm. He presents like, you know, like Financial Times does interviews with him, and they characterize him that way. But he is an elite just like all these other ones, operating in exactly the same way. He's just trying to achieve certain policy ends that we would call fascist or whatever, you know, like, but yeah. He talks in the email as recently as 2018, he's talking to Epstein in this email about using the Fed as like a tool of basically class war, or like, you know, using it against workers. Mm-hmm. And he calls it like an exquisite tool or a sophisticated tool or something like that, weapon. Mm-hmm. But this is like what he's talking about, I think, and nobody's picked up on this, is how we've used the Fed to send billions of dollars to Milei in Argentina. Mm-hmm. Right? You're using the Fed to actually bolster a far right government in another country. And you're even, Trump is even making that support conditional on the far right government staying in power. And he's like, we'll take all this money back, you know?
Yeah, yeah, I mean, I know he made an offer to the Argentine voters. Like, you yeah. know, like if you don't want to, like, a recession, you know, like, you better vote for my boy. I mean, if you're thinking about it, you know, in terms of like these, like, kind of like big structures, and like it is useful to think about the far right as a byproduct of this, and is like, you know, like able to exploit some of the contradictions. I mean, I think that, I mean, it is very ironic, but true that like the people who first promoted the Epstein story were like the people like Bannon, like you know, like it'd be precisely.
Isn't that weird?
Yeah. No, but I mean, they saw it as a way of neutralizing any sort of like criticism of Trump himself, like basically, you know, saying like, you know, if you bring up stuff about our guy, we, you know, we'll, we can bring up Epstein. But also, I mean, like they're kind of, I mean, yeah, Bannon, they're both aware of how bad this stuff looks to ordinary people, and are willing to exploit it, even though, you know, like Bannon was quite close to Epstein. I was close to Epstein, like, you know, like not in like the period where people could have plausible deniability. This is what we're talking about, like 2017, 2018.
Post-conviction, yeah.
Yeah, post-conviction, yeah.
What can I ask you? You had like 2 weeks before Epstein was found dead in his cell. You had like before.
You had
tweeted out something very prescient. What was that? And like, what was how does your prescience come about here?
Well, I what had happened was like there had been initially a report of like a suicide attempt by Epstein and that he was under watch. And there was like a lot of people tweeting like, oh, you know, like it'd be great if Epstein did kill himself. And I just like tweeted like, well, no, actually, like, you know, like Epstein knows a lot of things about very important people and that we need his testimony and that he should be like under very careful watch. And I wrote that 60 days before Epstein ended up dead in his cell. So yeah, I guess kudos to me. But I mean, yeah,
I called it.
But it also seems like in some ways the unwillingness of the fact that the paradox that someone like Bannon and Thiel and all these people like are, you know, they sponsored J.D. Vance, right? And Vance was like their guy. And Vance was the guy who was like went on all the podcasts saying, you know, release the Epstein files. And this looks like, you know, Vance was saying like the reason people believe in Pizzagate is because of Jeffrey Epstein. And, you know, he doesn't talk like that anymore. But he was saying, like, this is like Vance, you know, representing this right wing faction was able to use it. And I think it's partially because the right is very attuned to the sort of contradictions of liberalism and the way that these contradictions can be like exploited to discredit the existing establishment and for their own power. And I think one example of this contradiction, well, there's two examples, one of which is, you know, after Epstein's death, it was the right that took up the slogan, Epstein didn't kill himself. And you saw a lot of liberals basically saying, well, there's nothing to see here. Like, prison suicides are quite common. And, like, this is a standard, like, liberal, you know, mainstream liberal line. And I think that, like, it's the extent to which, the, you know, the mainstream liberal position was, like, there's nothing to see here. You know, this is just, like, rumor mongering and conspiracy theories. Like, that actually does create an opening to the right.
Liberals are too credulous. No offense to liberals listening, but, like, they're too credulous about power. Like, yeah. When power tells you something, you can't just believe it. And like, if there's anything I agree with within MAGA, which is basically nothing, it's that they are skeptical of elites who rule us, you know?
Yeah.
or some of
the elites. Yeah, but they use that skepticism to put their faith in people like Bannon, you know, and Thiel, who are like...
Also elites.
Yeah, also elites. And then Vance, and J.D. Vance. I mean, the more recent example of this, which is, I think, very telling, is, like, as I mentioned before, there's, you know, all this great reporting at Reason and at Dropsite on Epstein's ties to the national security state. But where you will not find any of this reported so far is in the New York Times, in the Washington Post, or on CNN. And there might
Can't imagine why.
And I mean, there's a couple of things that are perhaps going on there. One of which maybe is like the sort of the sourcing of this. I mean, like, I think that there is a kind of organization that received hacked information from Ehud Barak's thing. But I mean, like, that hack, that information seems like all valid. Like, there was a lot of emails there with photos and private information about Barak that wasn't available anywhere else. So I mean, these, like, everything you can, when you received hacked material like that, you can sort of check it out. And, you know, like, it seems totally legitimate. But, and I guess some people claim that this hacked information might have came from Iranian intelligence, which, again, like to my mind, I'll stipulate that that's the case. But, like if Iranian intelligence, you know, has accurate, you know, like hacked information about something that happened and made it available, like, I don't actually see that as a reason, like, not to... use that as a basis of reporting.
If it's available, it's available. You know, it's news.
It's available. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, the whole unwillingness of the mainstream media to talk about this, I think it actually does contribute to sort of the far right and to conspiracy theories. And even, like, you know, I would say in this particular case, sort of like anti-Semitic conspiracy theories, like you know, the idea that this is all part of a kind of Jewish cabal, when, like, Epstein was fairly typical member in a lot of ways, like, leaving aside his, like, crimes, but like, in terms of his worldview and his politics, a very typical member of the American elite. But I'd like your thoughts on, like, what do we say about, like, this kind of, like, weird news blackout? Because I mean, like, the Dropsite has been reporting on this stuff for, like, a couple of weeks now, and none of this is like reached the mainstream media.
Well, it's like the conspiracy theory deepens by the dog that didn't bark. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, once this information's out and it's so damning, and yet they find it still unnewsworthy, that's not credible anymore. That mm-hmm. justification doesn't hold water at this point. And some of the emails show is that CNN, Donna Brazil, mm-hmm. some reporters at the New York Times, they are also in touch with Epstein, also backdooring information to him, previewing mm-hmm. things, right? And so it's like mainstream media, I'm sure there's lots of, like, good, normal people who just have honest politics in mainstream media, but there are lots of people in mainstream media who do not fit that description. And mm-hmm. like, some of them are named, you know? And so like, it's like, of course, like, this is one of the things. So like, in the Epstein geopolitics post I did for the newsletter, I walked through some of this from the Dropsite news reporting, which is that, like, Richard Clark, the cybersecurity czar, Leon Panetta, who is my boss in Obama's Pentagon, like Jeremy Bash, who is Leon Panetta's chief of staff, all these guys, Bill Burns, who was Obama's like ambassador to Russia, like a who's who of Democratic Party national security people. Mm-hmm. Who's who was also in the Epstein files, was also mm-hmm. colluding, sharing information, changing policies based on consultations with Epstein. Mm-hmm. And those people are the best and the brightest who give pull quotes to the New York Times, who are interviewed mm-hmm. by the New York. I'm not focusing on just New York Times, but like mainstream media. They're the ones who go on MSNBC and CNN mm-hmm. and all that. And so all of the whole, like, mainstream layer of elites, they're all sort of collectively implicated here. So if you're a journalist at a mainstream newspaper or on MSNBC or whatever, if you report on this, you're telling on yourself almost. Like, you're at risk of, like, you stabbed Caesar too, man. You can't go tell everybody, you know?
And so, yeah, yeah. I think that's right. I mean, particularly, it is a case that like some of the behavior of the journalist, and I'll mention like one particular name because he made a lot of money from an anti-Trump book, is Michael Wolff.
Who was
totally like, you know, like it seems to have been like best buds with Epstein, and was like giving him heads up, like, you know, warning him about like certain negative press coverage that might be coming up, or, you know, rumors that he heard, in a way to protect Epstein. And like, you know, like I can certainly see like something like that, it does not do any credit to the media. And, you know, like obviously there's going to be a partisan lens. A lot of this is news because Donald Trump is president, and, you know, he is very much was very much connected with Epstein, and the stuff that we've has come out has been very disturbing. But I mean, like, I think we would be amiss if we didn't acknowledge that, like, this actually implicates a far wider spectrum of people than just Donald Trump. You know, across both political parties, it is it's not a Donald Trump scandal. It's like an American political elite scandal,
of which Trump is a part.
Yeah.
And that's why the partisan lens really doesn't work, you know. We didn't even mention Larry Summers, who is king of Turd Mountain. I mean, like, just it comes across as an off. I've written before, like years ago, before I knew about the Epstein stuff, that he was just like, he had awful views about everything. And like Yanis Varoufakis had this giant memoir that he wrote after he was like Greek finance minister or whatever, and Yanis is like good guy, good politics, friend of the pod type person. And in the memoir, though, he opens it up with an anecdote about a conversation he had with Larry Summers the first time he goes to Washington. And can I read this out real quick?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, no, please. It's very relevant. Yeah.
So this is from Yanis's memoir. Larry Summers says to him, "There are two kinds of politicians," he said, "insiders and outsiders. The outsiders prioritize their freedom to speak their version of the truth. The price of their freedom is that they are ignored by the insiders, who make the important decisions. The insiders, for their part, follow a sacrosanct rule: never turn against other insiders and never talk to outsiders about what insiders say or do. Their reward? Access to information and a chance, though no guarantee, of influencing powerful people and outcomes." With that, Summers arrived at his question. "So, Yanis," he said, "which of the two are you?" It has so much more flavor in light of all these emails.
Yeah, no, absolutely, absolutely. Yeah. No, we'll mention, Summers' relationship with Epstein had been known like for a long time, but what the newer revelations flesh out, which I hadn't fully been cognizant of, it was that, you know, like, he was in communication with Epstein, like, you know, on the year that Epstein died, like, you know, like within months of like Epstein. So very late, and he's has a lot of like very friendly, sociable things where he's asking for, he's a, you know, married man, whatever, but he's asking for advice on like various women that he's romantically interested in, and asking Jeffrey Epstein, which is like, making comments about, I don't know if people quite caught this, but he had this comment like, "Oh, I told him, you know, like, women have half the intelligence of the world. I didn't mention that, you know, women are more than 51% of the population," which is like a sly way of saying like, you know, well, actually, women are stupider than men, which is what Summers actually believes, because when he was president of Harvard, he would go into like, you know, long discourses about how women didn't have quite the IQ for in math that men do. This is a famous, like, one of the causes for him to, when he was forced out of being president of Harvard, and also like trying to get Epstein to secure money for his wife. She's a English professor at Harvard, and her project of like filming various people reading poetry to make sure that like the money stays in her hands and is not, you know, has to be divvied up with Harvard, sort of financial advice of that sort. And then she herself wants to suggest to Epstein various books about men that, you know, like are influenced by contact with young girls, including Vladimir Nabokov's Lolita. It was just like, the whole thing is like, really,
you couldn't write this. I mean,
No. It's just like, it's actually like, you know, I started off with not a very high opinion of Larry Summers, but I wasn't expecting it to be this bad.
You know, like I was super late to feminism, and like just as a worldview or like a mode of analysis, and like one, there's many reasons for that. One of the reasons for that is because my contact with feminism, like initially when I was in the national security state, it came in the form of this like agenda that was called Women, Peace, and Security, so mm-hmm. WPS, and every dude that I knew who was like involved in WPS, and they would go to these like feminist conferences where they would get on a stage and talk about inclusion and all these mm-hmm. things and diversity. The specific dudes that I knew who were doing that were the scumbaggiest people on earth. Like they were pure hypocrites, like misogynists. They would go to Thailand and then, you know, do human trafficking stuff. Like it was the worst, lowest bottom of the barrel type like people. But they were like the ones who were espousing these virtues that were the opposite of how they like lived and conducted themselves in power. And so the hypocrisy of it made it such a farce to me. And I'm like, why are other feminists, like real feminists, going along with this? Like, what is the deal? And then you see in the emails, I haven't said that out loud very much, but you see in the emails exactly what I'm talking about. And Larry Summers is like an avatar of this. He's like wildly misogynistic, anti-feminist, to the point of actually thinking women are stupid as a category. Yeah. Like, just wild, man. But then he talks about inclusion. He's like, I went to the Saudis and I yipped about inclusion.
Exactly. Yeah. No, but again, I mean, like one of the ways that this does serve the right is that it confirms, you know, like one part of their critique, you know, like it actually does show the kind of liberal elite at its kind of like hypocritical worst. You know, like so I mean, in some ways, both the that kind of centrist elite and the far right, you know, are often seen as opposites, but in some ways they're part of the same system where they're like, you know, one is a kind of logical outgrowth of the other. But I mean, there's so much more we could say, but you know, like for our purposes, we're out of time. But I want to thank Van Jackson once again for being on the podcast. And did you have any closing out thoughts before?
I want to thank Jeet here for coming on the podcast. This was fun. And like, yeah, there was so much more we could have said, but another day maybe.